And we move to the sixth case today. Mr. Rolig?
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court, counsel, Tim Rolig on behalf of defendant Arturo Orozco Vasquez. I'm going to address the sentencing issue and answer any questions the court may have about the sufficiency of the evidence issue. But the sentencing issue is essentially this, that the sentencing court made certain findings that were clearly erroneous in this case. They were factual findings. The sentencing court was very explicit when he went through and said, I find. And we attack four of those findings in this case, and it was those findings that the court then used to increase the sentence. It was not a small increase in the sentence, given that the advisory guideline range was 63 to 78 months. He increased it 42 months off of that range that he had to work with on the advisory guideline range. And as the court's aware, and it's cited in both briefs, that the farther you get away from the advisory guideline range, the more compelling the reasons need to be. And so I think in that context, therefore, the facts that you find that increase based on need to be clearly there in the record. And in this case, those weren't.
Mr. Rolig, looking at the district court's six reasons, many of them, it seems to me, are indisputable on this record. You know, he was arrested after having been deported to Mexico, and he's now in the U.S. illegally. Well, no, I mean, he can't dispute that. He used another identity. That seems to be clear, which the district court rather pointedly characterized as his being a deceiver or a liar. He's a large-scale drug dealer. Well, you had the jury finding. Certainly the judge can rely on the jury finding that in this instance he had been found guilty. Wasn't supporting his children, lack of work history. It seems to me this all gets down to the judge's reasons for thinking that with respect to the gang ownership. Isn't the focal point of your argument the judge's reliance on the gang?
Well, it's not just the gang, but what I take from your question, Your Honor, is that there's no question that the sentencing court is weaving together an assortment of factors.
And many of the reasons he gives, it seems to me, are well supported on the record.
There are reasons that are
inferences from the Mexican posse that, you know, whether it's the shooting in 1997 or whether it's his continued membership or whether his alleged lies to the court or the judge saying, I know drug lingo when I hear it, or, you know, or words to that effect. That's where I think maybe you need to focus.
Well, Your Honor, those are all, I agree in to the extent that those are all facts that the court relied upon, and they certainly were not sufficiently established in the record. And my reasoning for tying these all together is I think it's somewhat difficult in reading the sentencing court's analysis to pick out and choose exactly what was the single or maybe group of factors that were the most important factors in relation to increasing this 42 months. It seems that when he used the words, I make a finding, that seemed to have a special significance. And certainly one of those was the gang inference issue that was clearly not established, I think, clearly not established in the record, and particularly the 1997 shooting. I think that the sentencing court simply went too far in making that. And the issue then becomes is basically what are the factors that he can make these findings on and whether the factors are sufficient that he did make the findings on under 3553.
Could I ask you, I mean, you attached all these photographs to your brief. Were these ever sort of authenticated, dated, placed, timed?
One was dated for after the time frame of 1997, which was the time frame in the PSR that the defendant had said that he had last been a member of the gang. Now, he admitted in the PSR in paragraph 68 that he continued to associate with gang members. So when the court finds that he's lying about that, the court's, again, making a mistake there because he's not lying about it. What he's saying is he's not a member of the gang. And actually, the court's ruling analysis calls him both a member and an associate. So it was unclear whether at least in my mind, whether the court was making the specific finding that he was a member or and or an associate or both.
Why does it make any difference?
Well, I think
The court is entitled to reject the defendant's assertions to the PSR writer and accept a contrary version of reality, provided that there's record evidence to support it. And it seems to me that there is plenty of record evidence to support his gang involvement in some fashion or another.
I agree with that analysis, Judge, except for the fact that the court focused on the lies and the statements that the defendant supposedly made, and then made some inference that he was lying about a shooting, for instance, that was gang-related, none of which, and inferences back that was a gang-related shooting, for instance, is not supported by the record and is not supported by any of the evidence. Mere membership alone in the gang is not going to be sufficient to find that he was shot because of that membership. Or that he admits to being an associate member is sufficient.
With respect to that item, I don't think that's one line item, if you will, that Judge Randa actually made an explicit fact finding. He didn't say, I find that shooting was gang-related. He rejected the defendant's benign explanation in favor of an inference that it probably had something to do with his membership in the gang. I mean, it seemed to me that it was phrased in that way, not as an explicit finding of fact, but as evidence that he is not telling the truth about his continued involvement in the gang.
Except right after making that finding, the judge says, I can't believe anything you say. So I think that what it is it's not...
In other words, you're not a credible person.
Right, you're not
a credible person. You make these assertions, and there's nothing wrong with that conclusion on the part of the judge.
There's nothing wrong with it, I would agree, if he's basing it on facts that are available. And in this instance, in these four instances, there are no facts available that can support that inference. And he's basing it, at least in part, on those exact findings, the shooting in 1997, the bringing of the drugs into the bathroom, and those other facts. And I think that what this court should require of a sentencing court in those instances is that if they're going to put emphasis on those facts, that those facts be supported by the record. Because what we're left with then in a situation like this is a situation where there are factors that are considered that are legitimate, and then there are several factors that are considered that are not legitimate. And it's the sentencing court's role, I think, in choosing what the appropriate sentencing is in this case, is to try to sort through the appropriate facts and the appropriate inferences that come through to reach a sentence. Here we don't have that. And I don't think that it would be this court's role to then pick and choose among those that are actually stated in the record that might be appropriate. Instead, I think it's the district court has to rely on what's the appropriate facts. If there are any questions about the sufficiency of the evidence, I'd be happy to answer those. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Koenig?
May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Koenig. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and I appear on behalf of the United States. If they find the dope on you, you're sunk. That's what we learned during the previous argument. This is not one of those cases. This is a case in which the evidence that was sufficient to convict the defendant was circumstantial. When I was in law school, my evidence professor used to give the example of snowfall. You wake up in the morning and you see snow on the ground. You can be pretty confident about saying it snowed last night, even though you didn't see the snow coming down out of the sky. Is it possible that a Hollywood film crew showed up in your neighborhood overnight with a snow machine and made it look like snow? It's remotely possible, but extremely unlikely.
But Mr. Koenig, I assume this pertains to the conviction, but what I'm concerned about, and this is something that is kind of an issue in this post-Booker world, is when a district court decides that it's not going to sentence inside the range recommended by the guidelines, as this district judge did. We all know that that's a permissible decision, but our decision in Dean essentially said the further out you go, the more compelling your justification has to be. My guess is if this district judge had chosen a sentence of 21 months, in other words, the same 42-month deviation but down from the bottom of the range instead of up from the top of the range, you guys would have been here in a nanosecond arguing that this was an unreasonable sentence and that it needed heaven knows what kind of justification. And I'm uncomfortable with a double standard, for one thing. And back in the old days, you used to justify departures by something tied to the structure of the guidelines. We used to say, you know, if it was criminal history that was underreported, you might go up a notch on the criminal history grid. This 42-month number kind of comes out of the blue, and I don't see anything different about the justification that Judge Randa gave here from the justifications I'm seeing every day for sentences inside the guideline range. So maybe you can help me figure out what it is we need to ask of the district court judges to justify such a very large percentage-wise departure or change.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, you're probably right. If the shoe were on the other foot, we would be making that argument. I think we tried that in a case that was decided last week, and it didn't turn out in our favor, as I recall. Like, the name of the case is not right at the tip of my tongue. This is a significant above-the-guidelines sentence. It is certainly relative to the guidelines range. The statutory maximum for the offense, I believe, is 40 years. So viewed in that light, it's not as significant a departure as it could be.
Well, that's certainly true. But, I mean, with all of this post-Booker, you know, you start with the guidelines. It's not inappropriate, I think, for us to start with that 63 to 78-month period of time and figure, you know, all of our talk about accumulated wisdom and so on. I mean, that's what it works out to for Mr. Orozco-Vazquez, except that the district judge here thought it needed to be 42 months longer. Why that? How do you assess that number? It really has an out-of-the-air feel to it.
It's true that there isn't any sort of mathematical analysis. You know, I am going X percentage above the guidelines, and therefore I need to find all of the factors under 3553A or anything like that. But I think the district judge...
Would you be happier if they had to do that, if we assume even-handedness? I mean, it might be useful to the government in opposing downward adjustments if there were some actual rules about how to do this.
I wonder, frankly, Your Honor, if that would undermine the advisory nature of the guidelines and the discretion that the Supreme Court apparently thinks that judges ought to have in order for the guidelines to be constitutional.
Sure. No, I mean, I understand that, and I guess it's just kind of a take the bad with the good in some sense.
Yes. And I would say, as I've argued in the brief, that we don't think that the judge was at all sloppy in his analysis of the 3553A factors.
What worries me about the judge's decisions is that there are places in this record where he seems to be relying on things that aren't really in the record, such as his reliance on the gang lingo or his assumptions that mere association with the gang means that you're also participating in everything that the gang does. I don't know where the record evidence of that is.
Well, on gang affiliation, we have, of course, his admitted past. We have the photographs. We have the fact that
one photograph is dated, but do we know when the others were taken? Are they authenticated in any way?
The district court, I think, believed that some of the photos were later because they showed signs of aging.
Is that
the defendant looked
enough,
older?
Yeah, as evidence.
I'm not sure that there was any expert evidence on that point. But one final point on that issue, of course, is that the defendant was arrested for the instant offense in the company of two Mexican posse gang members with a gun in his shoe.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you look at the entire picture...
the judge has to bring something. I mean, he's not viewing it in a vacuum. He's had experience on the bench dealing with things like that, which is appropriate for him to use. Back in the real old days, we wouldn't even be here. There would be no appeal of the sentence.
That's correct, Your Honor. And also, as Judge Wood noted earlier, for the most part, Judge Randa did not have to rely on inference or his experience as a judge, particularly in finding that this defendant was not credible, because there were a number of undisputed facts pointing in that direction, the use of an alias, The very fact that he came back to this country after being removed and cautioned that he couldn't come back, and again using the alias when he did that, we would ask you to affirm both the sentence and the conviction in this case. Unless you have any further questions, I'll rest on my brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Rowling?
You have 2 minutes, Mr. Rowling.
Thank you. I don't have any rebuttal, but I'm willing to answer any questions if there are any questions. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.